Do you think a referendum will improve or stall the fate of these counties? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Getting into this conversation that has been going on in the country, you know, as regards where we are as a people and what we, you know, we want to do as a country. And to just get more into this conversation, today we're going to talk to Grace Count Owuor, and the conversation is about the fate of counties. Welcome, Francis. Can you introduce yourself?
Thank you so much, Mr. Darius. My name is Viscount Kowor. I'm a human rights activist, and we've engaged in a number of issues as part of our civil society organization network engagements, issues of leadership, governance, politics. And, you know, for the past few months, much engagement has been on the Building Bridges Initiative. And I want to believe that is the area on which we want to engage today.
Yeah, most definitely. And just to jump right in, and what do you make of the recent poll that showed, you know, popularity ratings across the country? And a lot of the counties or regions, it didn't get more than 50% approval.
Okay. As much as polls are never purely scientific as to ensure 100% accuracy, but I want to believe that the recent polls are a true depiction of what is happening on the ground, the feelings of Kenyans, the opinions of the majority as regard BBI, because from the very beginning, the Building Bridges Initiative has never been popular with the people of Kenya, basically because the priorities, as far as the people of Kenya are concerned, the priorities of BBI have never been right according to them, because for them, BBI is addressing issues that are remote to the basic interest and the survival needs of the majority of Kenyans. You know how the cost of living has worsened in the recent past owing to the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, bad economic policies that has been implemented by the Jubilee government, plus a number of issues that has made life very difficult for any ordinary Kenyan. So when politicians came around with BBI and they looked at the issues that BBI was addressing, many Kenyans think that that is not their priority right now. And as the polls suggested, if we were to go to a referendum today, without the influence of the politicians, of course, many Kenyans would vote out the proposals that are in the initiative. So I agree with the polls. That is the opinion of the majority of Kenyans. They do not agree with the proposals that have been made to change the constitution.
Okay, that is interesting because one of the things, of course, the BBI proponents are saying is we can raise allocations to counties, which do not to 35%.
We have to look at the proposal to increase the share of revenue to the counties to 35% within the premises of the constitution as it is, which says that a minimum of 15% of national revenue will go to the counties. Minimum means anything above 15 is workable. It can be 20, 25, 30, 35, and it is practical that way, because then Parliament, that is the Senate and the National Assembly, will look at the obligations of the national government and that of the counties and come up with a figure that is workable for both the counties and the national government. So that is why there's a leeway, there's an allowance, so long as it is not anything below 15. So even within the premises of the current constitution, without amending any clause or article, the national government can give to the counties any share that is above 15. It can be 35 or even 40. So that proposal in itself does not need a constitutional amendment. And you're asking if it was just a sweetener so that it makes BBI more acceptable to the people. Yes, it is. Is it workable? when you look at the current crisis that we have in terms of the external debt, right now we are paying up to 1 trillion towards external debt. Our collection of revenue is something around 1.5. So it means that the national revenue, which we are proposing 35% of it to go to the counties, when we look at it in terms of our burden that we have to settle in terms of debt, then even if the sweetener were to pass through in a referendum, then it would not be workable. Because at the end of the day, we have to pay external debts. At the end of the day, there are national functions that have been that have to be implemented. And when you say that we are now sending 35% after we paid everything, then you know it's not workable. So we would rather remain with the current dispensation that gives the national government more room to decide how much to allocate to the counties without injuring the functions that should be undertaken by the same national government. And we must look at, first of all, how to renegotiate the external debts so that we can get more to give to the counties. Without that negotiation, and maybe looking at fiscal policies that can enable us implement our development programs without much borrowing, then that should be the way to go.
All right. I mean, Viscount, thank you for, that clarification. But that also then builds into another issue, which is, in your perspective, do you feel we have, to the best of our ability, interpreted and executed the 2010 Constitution?
Mr. Dyres, if you can reflect back on the conversations that we've had on the issue of the referendum and BBI, majority of the opponents of BBI have stated clearly that we have not fully implemented the 2010 Constitution, so that we can say we have implemented it and there are certain gaps that are there. And on the basis of those gaps, then we can propose certain amendments to strengthen the Constitution as it were. That has not been done. There are a number of articles, provisions, and principles of the Constitution that have not been implemented so far. I can give you an example of the chapter on leadership and integrity. Our leaders, our politicians have no goodwill. They have no intention of fully implementing that article. So if we were to go through the right way of doing things, then we are supposed to fully implement the 2010 Constitution. Then afterwards, identify gaps. If there are any, then we propose amendments to strengthen and not to weaken the Constitution.
There's the question, of course, of lockdowns. There's the question of economic concerns. There's the question of curfews. How does amend the Constitution movement fit in with where the country is?
Personally, I think it borders immorality for politicians to put their interest ahead of national interest, especially in view of the pandemic that has ravaged the entire world. And Kenya in particular, we are grappling with a lot of issues, with the high cost of living, with high food prices, with job losses. Lockdown has had tremendous impacts on the local economies. So for politicians to put all that in the back burner and instead jostle to try to change the Constitution and insisting that we must have a costly referendum instead of putting in place interventions that can at least make life manageable for the people. I want to tell you that the referendum for the people of Kenya is not a priority right now.
So what would you say, in your view, would be the top concerns for the term we commonly use, the common mwananchi?
The concerns are very clear. People speak in radio conversations, in TVs, in interviews. The concerns are very clear. We must put in place interventions to ensure that the job losses that we have experienced, how can we restore people in terms of livelihoods? We need to open more markets. We need to spend more on programs that can give can have some direct impact on the lives of the people. You know, of late, the Jubilee government policy has been massive spending on infrastructure without linkages with the local economies, without linkages with industry, without linkages with agriculture, trade, and those other things. And we are borrowing to spend heavily on infrastructure without the linkages. The intervention right now would be to come up with policies that spending not on big projects, but on programs that can put money in the pockets of the people. So we are looking at capitation, not in terms of machinery, but in terms of labor, employing as many Kenyans as possible to engage and participate in a number of programs. Then therefore, their capacity can be built and they are able to earn and have their livelihood restored.
Still staying on that beat, what are the chances of having a referendum before the 2022 elections? What is your prediction in terms of how Kenyans will vote? And number three, why?
I'm happy that the IBC has already released their timelines, and there are certain things that have to be done in the next 3 months, 4 months, 6 months. So the calendar is already full. We are a few days' time, by August 9th, we will be fully in an election year. And the timelines that are there that have been set. So to come in with another program that is as massive as a referendum, then that is not workable. So I'm very sure that it is not possible to hold a referendum this year. And even if you look at the existing elections, laws that are related to our elections, there are certain things that you cannot do in an election year. For example, you cannot delimitate new constituencies and have them affected in a period that's less than 1 year. So, Mr. Darius, I am very sure that looking at the timelines of IBC, the cost of a referendum, it will not be possible to hold a referendum before 2022.
In the event that we still go ahead and hold it, what is your prediction, your crystal ball, in terms of how Kenyans will vote and what will inform how different counties and how different regions will vote, in your view?
I have only one fear, and that is the influence of politicians on Kenyans. You know, a big percentage of Kenyans are not able to read for themselves these documents, and they are relying on the politicians to conduct sensitization, to hold rallies, and to tell them what to do. So I fear that if you were to go into a referendum, Kenyans would not be in a better position to make decisions for themselves. But the majority that are enlightened enough, the majority that are literate, are emphatic that they would not vote for the BBI proposals. So it is really difficult to say right now on the ability of the political elites to sway the opinions and the decisions of Kenyans when it comes to a referendum.
Okay. The other thing being, the High Court, I mean, temporarily, stalled the BBI process, of course, the whole conversation about moving to the Court of Appeal and all these, basically provisions and requirements that they've set out. Do you feel those legal reservations by the judiciary were necessary?
For me, the judiciary is like a cog in this process of democratization that is coming in to help a lot, because the people are becoming helpless in the face of so much impunity among the political elites. So coming in and stalling the BBI, of course, on grounds that are reasonable, that are justifiable, grounds that are legal. So for me, the judiciary has become a savior of the people of Kenya when it comes to the impunity with which the political elite were trying to push through the proposals to amend the constitution.
And then also now, in your view, how has devolution fared? Do you think a referendum will improve or stall the fate of these counties?
Fortunately, I would say so. The sweetener of 35% going to the counties. We know that can still be implemented within the premises of the current constitution, but as a sweetener, that proposal strengthens devolution in terms of ensuring that there are adequate resources going to manage programs and projects for the counties, even though looking at it in terms of fiscal viability, it might not be workable. But if it were to work, then I would say that particular clause, that particular proposal to increase more funding to the counties, then that would definitely strengthen devolution.
Okay. So I'm also just thinking in terms of infrastructural development. How does that square with the overall scorecard of both the local county, but also the national government?
Definitely, there is one area of success that we have to credit to the Jubilee government, and that is the area of infrastructure. Indeed, there are a number of roads that have come up. Some are still in the process of construction. There's a particular project from Aero to Hispania, and several components that are now complete, and they have ensured that the rural places have been opened up, towns have been connected, urban areas are up and running. And that is a particular success that we have to admit Jubilee has done well on, except on the area of linkages, because infrastructure on its own is not enough to rev up the economy. We must have several linkages, like in agriculture, in trade, in industry, entrepreneurship, and many other things. There must be commitments to ensure that there is increased activity on those areas. Then, therefore, you have an integrated mechanism where each sector is connected to another. For now, it's just infrastructure. Of course, there are benefits, but we still have to integrate it with other sectors for it to have some impacts on the economy.
I mean, the other question for me would be, urban life is becoming really tough and challenging, especially in the major cities. And would you say some sort of an urban to rural movement, is it viable? Is it something people should attempt as part of trying to survive?
Mr. Darius, it is inevitable that people will be moving because the nature of urban economy, and there are certain things that are inherent in an urban setup that make urban life more convenient to majority of the people. And so that movement is something that we will keep seeing. And it's good in one way, it's bad in another way. But now we have to look at the trends and say, now this is something that we have to deal with. A few days ago, I think just 2 days, former Prime Minister Raila Amolo Odinga gives proposals on how we can check on that movement by proposing certain economic activities that can then be initiated in rural places. But pundits disagree and say that you cannot check rural urban migration. People will move into urban areas. It is a trend all over the world. There is more urbanization going on than ruralization, if I could say that. So how do we ensure that we take into consideration and provide effective interventions on that trend? Industry is one thing that we look at, because with industries in urban setups, it means people moving in will immediately get engaged. And then we can leave much of the land for a large scale agricultural activities. The issue of centralization, like what you see is going on in Nairobi, where everything is happening in Nairobi, all resources are being directed to Nairobi. That is now the downside that we have to check. If we could decentralize functions, activities, projects, and programs to other urban areas, other cities, Kenya should have, for example, 6 cities, like in the provinces. You have Kisumu, you have Garissa on the other side, you have Mombasa, you have Eldoret, you have Nakuru, you have Kisii, all these coming up as cities. Then we decentralize resources, functions, and many other things, so that it is not just urban, rural to urban migration to a central point, like everyone going to Nairobi. No, it should be in all the urban settings, whether it is Rodi Kopany, for example, whether it is water everywhere, so that we look at trade, we look at industry, technology expanding in those areas. At the same time, much of the arable land is left for agricultural activities.
Okay, and I think just in closing, NGO spaces and the community-based organization spaces, we are about 16 months, 12 to 16 months going on into the next election. What are some of the plans, programs, systems that you people are putting in place in light of, you know, referendum calls and definitely a very hotly contested elections coming up?
There is a shift of paradigm that has happened in the international systems when the international community kind of neglected or abandoned local non-governmental organizations in terms of funding. It means that these organizations have been weakened. As we speak, very few organizations have been able to undertake activities that are meant to engage the people on governance issues. And that is why the politicians have had a leeway of influencing everything. So I have to admit and without doubt that we need to strengthen civil society. We need to strengthen advocacy and lobbying structures so that we can engage with the people. As things stand right now, with little funding going to local organizations, then even as we approach a general election, we will not be able to engage effectively with the people as civil society organizations.
All right. Thank you so much, Viscount, for your insight and conversations. It's always a pleasure.